Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy John, engineering and producing our program. We are off and running on Thanksgiving week already. It's Monday, November the 20th, 2023, in the Green Things, Zocalo Village Studio. They have the naming rights to our studio, and we're glad they do. We're on the campus of Bustos Media. We have five radio stations under one roof here, but this station is 1030 KVOI, Tucson's trusted voice for local news and talk. We have our worldwide live listening. You can hear our program anywhere in the world by going to my website, buckmastershow.com. That is also the place for all of our podcasts. Actually, now about 13 years of content has been archived since we started the radio show. The live line for our telephone interviews is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. It's time for our Monday one-on-one presented by our friends at Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing. If you're looking for any framing needs, this is the place to go. Family owned and run since 1985, Moe and his family specialize in custom frame mirrors, art for your walls. Moe is a fantastic photographer, and a lot of his stuff is available and on the walls at the gallery. And if after Moe and the team frame your particular piece of art and you just don't really want to do it yourself, putting it up on the wall, Moe will make house calls. They'll come out and make sure it goes up on the wall exactly the way you want it. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, right next to Copenhagen at Fort Lowell and Dodge, and at moesgallery.com. This week's one-on-one interview is with the City of Tucson's first urban forestry manager. Nicole Gillette is with us. Prior to her appointment with the city, and that was actually 3 years ago already, Ms. Gillette worked as a conservation advocate for the Tucson Audubon Society. Nicole, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Bill. This is my first time on live radio, so I'm excited.
Well, you should be excited. We're gonna get into the whole urban forestry. I guess it's a good time to be an urban forester because many cities across the country are realizing climate change is for real. And not only, I guess, are they hiring urban foresters in municipalities, but they're hiring actual people that deal just with the climate change. So it's an important time.
Yes, it's a very exciting time to be in this field, for sure.
Tell me about your role and kind of, if you could, give us kind of what you've been up to over the last 3 years since your appointment.
Yeah, thanks so much. As you mentioned, it's our almost exactly our three-year anniversary. Sometimes I can't really realize that we've made it this far. So about 3 years ago, they created, and by they, I mean the Tucson Mayor
City
and
Manager,
Council.
Yeah.
And they actually launched Tucson Million Trees. That's Mayor Romero's initiative. And that sort of kicked off this whole discussion around what's next for climate action in the city. And one of the first actions they took was to create my position. And I remember when I was hired, because it was the day after the election, was actually when I started that first year. And for the past 3 years, I've really been learning about the urban forest here in Tucson, sort of getting our feet underneath ourselves. It's the first time we've ever had a centralized program in the city, thinking holistically about trees and our urban forest. So it's taken a little bit here to sort of get our feet underneath ourselves, think about, as a program, where do we want to be and where are we going? And so, of course, a central component of that is Tucson Million Trees, which is our goal by 2030 to have a million new trees in the ground. And also, of course, we have to think holistically about trees from when they're planted throughout their entire lifespans to when we remove them. In a sense, they are our plants in the ground. They are our neighbors. They are alive, right? Plants and trees are alive. So they have a whole lifespan to consider. And we've, as a city, been thinking about, well, how do we plan and care for our urban forest holistically? And
a lot of people think, well, the trees in the desert, it just doesn't seem to go together.
Right.
They'll say that, well, we really can't afford the water for the trees. But the argument, and I'm sure you're going to tell us about why we should have trees in the desert, it's actually going to keep the temperatures down. That's a really big thing. What else?
Yeah, I mean, first off, if you you know, we live in a beautiful place. And if you take a walk out into the desert, we, of course, have trees. Mm-hmm. Trees are a piece of our ecosystem. And they're actually really our nursery grounds in the entire desert for all life, mm-hmm. right? That's where our saguaros grow up underneath trees. That's where all of our other pieces of the ecosystem really thrive. Because as you mentioned, that's where we're going to have shade. It's where we're going to be cooler. It's where water is going to be moving through the entire system. So taking a step back, of course, we do have trees in the desert. It's a key component to having life out here at all. In an urban space, in our city, trees can actually become a really critical piece of our city infrastructure. They are an investment like anything else we do in the city, and they help make our city a livable place. You know, anyone who takes a walk outside, if you're walking to the bus stop, if you're walking your dog, taking your kids to school, you can feel that difference, right? When you step out from your house into that blazing sunshine, take a couple steps under a tree, you can feel that 20, 30 degree difference. So trees can make all the difference.
I'm one of those people that want more trees, the more the better. And unfortunately, with climate change, the mm-hmm. storms have been a lot worse. On our own property in the central foothills up by the, as I call it, the Buckmaster Bungalow, we mm-hmm. lost some big trees this summer. The storms have become more violent, it seems, and I think climate change is responsible. And I think we're gonna really have a battle here, Nicole Gillette, just to save and kind of maintain right now the urban canopy mm-hmm. that we have. And I know you've been kind of mapping that urban canopy. How does it look overall? How are we doing when you see that canopy?
Yeah, I mean, as you put a nail right in it, right? It's tough to be a tree in the city right now. We are facing ever pressing challenges from climate change, extreme heat, drought, stronger storms. So citywide, it is certainly a tough place to be a tree. It is a struggle to get up and growing. And then once you're a mature tree, all the pressures that face you to stay alive and be a thriving tree. Mm-hmm. And so mapping-wise, yes, that's a key component of my program. You sort of need to know where you are before you can make any strides forward. And so Tucson Million Trees and the Urban Forestry Program are guided by a same data set. It's called the Tree Equity Score. It is live on our website if folks want to check it out. It is sorted by neighborhood, so you can actually go into that map, pick your neighborhood, and see how you're doing tree-wise. It takes into account the current canopy spread of that neighborhood, as well as things like heat resilience, and as well as a composite equity score. So you can see not only how are you doing canopy-wise, but how are you doing compared to the rest of the city as well. And that's how we are prioritizing all of our planting efforts, as well as our preservation efforts, as you mentioned.
What areas look pretty good and what need work?
Yeah, like any other equity map that we are using citywide, but also nationwide, you can see some really disturbing environmental trends citywide. We can map the areas that are, you know, typically more in our northern part of our city, also some parts in the east, and the downtown central area that have clearly had more investment over these years, canopy-wise and tree-wise. And then you start trending further west and further south, and we have some serious improvements to make in those areas.
The million trees, it sounds so ambitious. How are we going to get there, Nicole?
Tree by tree, Bill, is going to take everyone. A way that I sort of put it into perspective is, you know, if you're in our city core, we have about 500,000 people. And if you look at our whole region, we have about 1 million people. So even if in the city core, if everyone could plant 2 trees, we would be there, right? Mm-hmm. So it is tree by tree, and it's going to take everyone. It's certainly not just a city initiative. It's going to need to take place on people's homes. It's going to need to take place in commercial areas, in our parks. Every piece of land will benefit from more shade, and so it really is a citywide project.
And you think maybe you're about 1/10 of the way there?
Yeah, and you know, it's been a challenge even just to count trees, right? And we haven't had the systems in place to think about that. That's citywide, and so that's been part of my first, you know, for first couple of years is just how are we tracking trees? How are we keeping account of the trees that we already have? And it's been quite the data struggle, for sure.
Let's talk about that after we take a break, about how you are counting and if this is a mix between trees planted by the city and then individuals, and kind of break that down, take a deeper dive into what lies ahead for reaching a million new trees in the city of Tucson. But right now I want to talk about Mona's Danish Bakery. They are extremely busy, of course, getting ready for Thanksgiving. I talked with Steve, the owner, on Saturday as I put in my order for a couple dozen dinner rolls, because we are doing a Thanksgiving potluck at the Buckmaster Bungalow in honor of Anne. And so I strongly suggest today, maybe tomorrow, is kind of pushing it, because they're, I think Steve said they've already got 500 orders for pies, and he thinks they could very well break the record of last year, which was 600 orders. I know I went in there on Wednesday last year before Thanksgiving, and the boxes were piled all the way to the ceiling. Anyway, they're at Mona's Danish Bakery. Their website is Mona's Danish Bakery, and they are open right now for lunch, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. We'll be back. It is our Monday one-on-one, presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing. We're talking trees with Tucson's urban forester, Nicole Gillette. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops, craft beer, and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan to the RTA board by December. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things, Zocalo Village Studio. We're doing our Monday one-on-one with Nicole Gillette. She is Tucson's first urban forester. She's now been on the job, actually her three-year anniversary is this month. And we are doing our Monday one-on-one, which is presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing. They're right next to Copenhagen. And they are located at Fort Lowell and Dodge, and their website really looks good. They've revised it, moesgallery.com. Nicole Gillette has been talking with us about her role as an urban forester and looking at the canopy, but I want to get in now to this planting a million trees, the Mayor Romero's initiative. Speaking of Mayor Romero, she'll be our guest tomorrow. Here on the show. So if we've got about 100,000 trees, Nicole, toward the million, is that a combination of people who have privately planted the trees and they've told you about it and between the city? How do you come up with these numbers?
Yeah, where do these numbers come from right now is a great question. And really, we've been focused sort of on our internal and direct partner plannings, mostly until we could get sort of our data game up, right, until we could start being comprehensive, but also careful about how we are counting our trees. So that number is reflecting our internal tree plantings, and also ones done directly with partners who are reporting back to us. I would love to get us to a place where we can really expand that effort and make sure that everyone knows that they can be a part of Tucson Million Trees and count every tree that's going in from just one in someone's backyard to, you know, a large scale planting that might be happening on someone's commercial property.
So if someone is planting or wants to plant a tree or two in their backyard, exactly, should they let your office know?
Yeah. So right now we do have a live tool up on our website where you can go in and you can report each tree individually as they get planted. We are looking at having a comprehensive campaign kickoff next year where we're really pushing that tool out, but also making it easier and more accessible for people. We have a lot of partners who I would love to work with, as again, it's going to take everyone. So I would love to be working directly with nurseries, with our private partners, and thinking about, you know, who is really putting trees in the ground citywide.
Are you working with Tucson Clean and Beautiful?
They are our primary planting partner right now. Okay. They are also the fiscal partner for Tucson Million Trees.
So what type of trees should we be planting? What are you thinking about, and what would you like to see more of?
Yeah, what a simple question that turns out to be very complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone who's been in Tucson for a decent amount of time here will know that our palette of plants has changed since we really put in most of our major trees back in like the 1950s and 60s. As you said, that was when some of our biggest trees have been put in the ground. Our Aleppo pines, our eucalyptus, those are very much not the same trees we are planting today. We've learned some things over time, but also our environmental conditions have changed. So today we are really focusing on native species first, that we know that those trees have evolved over thousands and millions of years to be the most, the perfect tree for our environment. We also work with a variety of drought tolerant and what we call near native trees. It's also a sort of live work in progress question. As climate change puts more pressures on our environment, I'm just saying that we need to be nimble, flexible, and really thinking about species diversity more than anything else.
All right. What are the native trees you're thinking about, and what would be considered close to the ones you said that are not specifically native but mm-hmm. do well here?
Yeah, that's getting close to my favorite tree question, which I struggle to answer with every time because it's ever-changing. But I think some of our top species right now that not only are doing well but are very popular with folks for planting, we're looking at classics like our velvet mesquite tree, which you see everywhere. That's probably our ride-or-die, always does well tree, looks great. Makes a great tree for many different conditions. We have our desert willow, which has beautiful purple and pink blooms.
I've got one of those in the backyard.
Yeah, it does well, looks
beautiful
great.
Beautiful tree.
And it's also a nice small tree, easy to take care of. Probably my favorite right now is our classic ironwood, which you'll see out in the desert. Man, is that just a tough tree, right? It can take almost anything, and it's very long-lived, over 1,000 years old for some of our oldest
Going
species.
Back to the velvet mesquite, yeah. We hear a lot about Chilean mesquites. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? And does the Chilean do well as well? Perhaps it doesn't do as well as the velvet, or you would have mentioned it.
Yeah, you know, again, things are complicated, but we have many different species of mesquite that can grow here. And what I like to say is it's always going to be the right tree for the right place. Each of these species will do well under certain conditions. The interesting thing about the velvet, as it's our native species, is it can actually host way more species than any of our non-native mesquites. So if you're interested in wildlife and sort of the other more comprehensive ecosystem services that our trees provide, I always say look native trees first.
Interesting you brought up the ironwood. I'm not too familiar with the ironwood, but you're saying that seems to be one of your favorites.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those native trees that's everywhere out in the desert, but just hasn't been as
popular.
People
don't think about it.
Yeah, no. But it's a beautiful tree. Its bark is very interesting, and those pink flowers are so distinctive in the desert. It's a hardy, hardy tree. It has all kinds of adaptations that make it thrive under many different conditions. It can survive drought. It has all these ways to protect itself. So I would really say that people should look to the ironwood more.
I didn't hear you talk about Palo Verde trees.
Mm-hmm. We have a variety of Palo Verde trees. Our state tree is the blue Palo Verde.
Mm-hmm.
The foothills in blue do great across the city. The blue really needs a large footprint, so it's not normally at the top of my list just for a city tree. It takes a little bit more space to plant it. We have a couple other popular trees that aren't necessarily on our native list but are doing very well. We have an adaptation of the southern live oak that is very popular right now. It's the Joan Leonetti oak. Mm-hmm. And that's a very typical tree that people might think of as a classic tree that has that sort of upright structure.
Name for Joan Leonetti.
Yes.
I remember Joan was so active with, of course, Tucson Clean and
exactly.
Beautiful. Interviewed her many times, not only here on the radio, but before that on my TV show. So, boy, she was a real fireball when it came to that whole Tucson Clean and Beautiful. So I'm glad there's a tree
named
after her.
Exactly.
So one thing that really made me sick are the neighbors who cut down some trees recently. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, and I like kind of coming back to it can be a tough place to be a tree in the city, right?
Just hug a tree today. You'll feel better. Go out and hug a tree. All right, go ahead. Sorry, Nicole.
No, you're spot on. It's, go out and hug a tree. Yes, so it can be a tough place to be a tree. We ask a lot of our public spaces, right? We ask a lot of our alleys, washes, and parks. They are really multi-purpose. And so are our trees. And I think some people can just forget sometimes that trees are alive, right? They are a live piece of our city infrastructure. They make up, our core green pieces of our public spaces. And they take time, money, and investment to grow. So if you're thinking about removing a tree as a temporary solution to a problem you are seeing, just remember, it probably took 15, 20 years, 30 years to get that tree to its size, and it's going to be difficult to replace. So it's not an easy solution to a problem, and that even within our neighborhood in public spaces, we need to be thinking long term about solutions.
Now let's talk about the water. These trees that you've mentioned don't need a ton of watering, or what?
Yeah, I mean, all of our native trees are going to be desert trees,
yes.
Right? They are going to require not as much water as those typical park trees, which are park and old school trees that may have required higher water tables, turf watering. That doesn't mean that they don't need no water, right? Like anything else, anything alive in the desert, water is life. And there is an investment conversation to be had there. in the city, we use what is called a one water approach. So we look at all of our water sources, whether it's reclaimed water, rainwater, and sometimes potable water, to look at all of the uses in the city, and trees and landscape fall on there as well.
If folks have some of these giant pines, mm-hmm. like we have up at our home, I believe it's worth the investment to try to protect these trees by having them treated so they don't get that tree disease that starts browning and then it can be too late. Quick comment on that, please, Nicole.
Yeah, like anything else, as I've been saying, trees require work and an investment, and I agree. If you have some large trees that are providing a large amount of your canopy, you can be thinking both about preservation, so what can you do to keep that tree alive, but also succession. So can we be planting different species so as that tree ages, you will still have canopy there when it does come time to take it down.
How can people get a hold of you? You said you've got quite a website, so let's talk about it real quickly.
Yeah, very easy to find us at the Tucson Climate Hub. Very, very easy to Google and find us, and our contact form is on there.
You said just Google what?
Tucson Climate Hub. Yep.
Climate Hub,
yep.
And then there's also that will get you there.
Exactly.
All right. Nicole Gillette, Tucson's first urban forester with her dream job, I think.
Absolutely.
I talked to you before the show, and you said this is really your dream job. This is what you wanted to, and you're in the right place at the right time.
Exactly.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Our Monday one-on-one presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and at moesgallery.com. Be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show and the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios as we kick off Thanksgiving week, and ran into Jan and Jack again this weekend. I love running into them of Green Things, and they tell me that they grew 21,000 poinsettias at Green Things, and they're actually many of them, thousands are already spoken for with different organizations. So they are your poinsettia headquarters, and I've got a couple of them. And the only thing you need to remember is they need a lot of water. So every couple of days, make sure that they are watered. But they're actually very beautiful. Green Things, 3384 East River Road. Their website's greenthingsaz.com. Zocalo Village is their sister business on site over there on their 13-acre site, all that wonderful pottery from Mexico. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Our contributor on aviation is JetBlue Captain Jet Lattice, retired JetBlue Captain Jeff Lattice. Jeff retired after 20 years with the company when he had to take that mandatory. 65 years old, they say, and this the law is, yeah, you got to leave flying commercial airlines. So he was had to retire, but he did fly nearly 20,000 hours of accident-free aviation, something he's very proud of, commanding the Airbus A320 and the A321. And Jeff's had quite a career, and it's still going on. I mean, he was a highly decorated retired combat fighter pilot. I don't think, Jeff, you ever really retire as a pilot.
My wife doesn't want me to retire.
Jeff also worked at the Pentagon. He's been following all the action over in Ukraine. He worked as an Air Force Special Weapons Officer at the Pentagon, and his latest opportunity in life is training corporate pilots. So, Jeff, it's a delight to welcome you into the studio.
Well, thank you, Bill. I'm glad to be here live today.
we're here live with you and not having to do the phone interview. And, of course, we had to do the phone interview a lot when you were still working for JetBlue. And this is probably the first Thanksgiving week in a quarter of a century you haven't been in airports working.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Because as I recall,
you were Thanksgiving off, yeah, I think, over the last 20 years anyway. Yeah. So,
but they round up pretty much everybody, because when you think about it, this could be one of the busiest travel weeks in the history of commercial aviation.
Yeah, right now they're predicting that Wednesday will be the busiest pre-Thanksgiving day ever.
Wow.
And we were talking before the show started that the heaviest travel day, this is all just in the United States, I want to say it was June 19th, sometime in June, and there were 53,000 flights, and that was a record here in the United States. So definitely we're out of the COVID slowdown, and we're into new territory. I saw where United's going to have almost 10,000 more flights than they did previously a year ago. So there's quite a bit more traffic, and as well, there's going to be a lot more people in the terminals.
Yeah, and you know, the FAA is saying that these near misses, we've had several highly publicized near misses, Jeff, as you know, this year. And the thinking is that the technology's one, outdated, and there's a staffing issue, and these are all issues that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed now.
Yeah, you know, What you're referring to primarily is the air traffic control system has just been underfunded for eons. I remember back, probably all the way back in the 90s, how behind they were, and I don't think they've ever caught up. As well as there was a slowdown in hiring new air traffic controllers over the past 3 years, now they're behind on that. And to train an air traffic controller, a lot of people don't realize how long that takes.
I can imagine.
At least a year.
Yeah.
So by the time they get through that, then they have to have supervision after they get out of training for a while. So it's a long road for them. It looks like they're trying to cut the FAA budget in terms of the air traffic control, which is probably a mistake at this point. You were talking about these near misses. They basically have broken it down into two separate types of incidents. One of them can be addressed by training, which we do, the job I'm in now. And those were they call them runway incursions. That's when an airplane gets on a runway without permission.
Mm-hmm.
That happened several times over the last year. Some of them were pretty high profile. Some of them were fairly close misses.
Wasn't one of them, Jeff, like 300 feet?
That was actually
at Houston, maybe? Was that the one at Houston?
Well, there's two different kinds.
All
there's
right.
Runway incursions that's on the ground.
Yeah.
And then the other ones that have been happening have been where an airplane will take the runway with an airplane
coming in,
cleared to land.
Oh, my.
And that is an air traffic controller issue primarily.
Uh-huh.
And that's the reason why when they did the analysis on all these near misses and they broke it down into two different categories, they see that the air traffic control issue, and that one that's probably more dangerous, I might say. They're both dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But that one is not necessarily something you can correct by training. That is definitely an instrument or a equipment problem. There is some inexperience, but also undermanned facilities.
Are they all reported, Jeff, in your career? What would be considered a, say, close call? I mean, just give our listeners some idea of what is generally a safe distance between aircraft.
Well, yeah. Technically in the air.
Yes.
It's anything less than 500 feet.
Okay.
That is...
But when you're in a jet going 500 miles an hour...
Well, there's clearance... Well,
okay.
When you're at altitude, there is a whole different way the rules kind of work.
Okay.
And there's less air traffic once you get above 18,000 feet. Once you go above 18,000 feet, you have to be in contact with air traffic control.
Mm-hmm.
The altitudes are separated. So
okay.
You have eastbound altitudes and you have westbound
they're
altitudes.
They're corridors.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Layers.
Yeah.
There used to be 2,000 feet separation. It's only down to 1,000 feet at altitude now because the systems are much better. That all changed about 20 years ago. So once you're in the air, that's usually not a problem, especially when you're above 18,000 feet.
It's landing in the takeoff.
It's down where the traffic gets more dense. You have a lot more general aviation down there. You have people that are coming in to land, for instance, so you have a central point where everybody's coming to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where some of these near misses are happening. But the ones that have happened mainly in the last year, it's usually been somebody on the runway and somebody that's been cleared to land, or somebody might be going around, mm-hmm. while this airplane comes on. That's been a couple of cases where the landing airplane realized there was an airplane on the runway. They started going around. This airplane went ahead and took off. Now you have a conflict with two airplanes.
Oh, boy.
Departing basically the same runway same time.
That's not good.
Luckily, they've been able to see each other.
Yeah.
If there would have been weather or something, it would have been a lot more difficult.
So who is that Is that a problem where somebody in the control tower may have dropped the ball?
Yeah.
Or was it a pilot maybe who wasn't listening as well as they should have?
In at least the cases that I've watched or listened to, it was the air traffic controller's fault.
Mm-hmm.
There has been some finger pointing. But when you actually listen to what they're actually saying and what the clearances are, it's definitely falls under, in most of these cases, an air traffic control blunder.
All right. We're going to talk more aviation with retired JetBlue Captain Jeff Lattice, who is a regular contributor concerning aviation on the Buckmaster Show. And we're just delighted to have him eyeball to eyeball with us here in studio. Be right back.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority Plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is collected throughout Pima County and averages more than $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Thinking about a river cruise? Let Bon Voyage Travel guide you to choose the perfect cruise to complement your vacation dreams. River cruising has become more popular than ever, and we know you have so many options to consider when selecting the destination, cruise line, and ship. At Bon Voyage Travel, we provide a comprehensive presentation on the top tips for river cruises and have a team of specialists to assist you. Visit bvtravel.com and view our River Cruise 101 presentation today.
This is John Trout. Catch me every weekday morning at 5 before Wake Up Tucson with America in the Morning. Breaking news, weather, politics, and sports on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. Buckmaster kicking off Thanksgiving week. Be a great time if you've got some time off. Most people do. Take a trip over to Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. Only about a three-hour drive. The website is southwestnewmexico.org. You'll be tempted with lots of outdoor activities like hiking in the Gila National Wilderness. Great places to stay. It's just a good getaway and a perfect time of year over in New Mexico. southwestnewmexico.org. Our contributor on aviation, retired JetBlue Captain Jeff Lattice, with me in studio. Jeff retired a year ago, this January, hit that 65-year-old mark, and then that's it. He's now training corporate jet pilots. And Jeff, you know, we were talking during the break, the FAA is really aggressively hiring, and if somebody's looking for kind of a neat job, you have to be a special kind of personality to handle that, but that might be a good career for some people.
Air traffic control.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, even, you know, not just pilots, but they're hurting in aviation-related jobs across the board right now.
How hard is that, though, with the training? And do they have quite a washout percentage?
Yeah, believe it or not, there is.
I bet.
It takes a special talent.
Yeah.
You have to kind of be able to think in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of picture things in space. Uh-huh. You know, with your brain.
Yeah.
My ex-wife was an air traffic controller.
Oh.
So, you know, I saw what kind of training she had to go through, and it's pretty intensive. But the pay's actually really good for a government job.
Yeah.
And you get to retire early.
What kind of money are they talking about?
It depends on where you go.
But, like, even starting, you're going to make pretty good money?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll make pretty good money almost anywhere. And if you go to some place that's like New York or Boston,
mm-hmm.
You could see six digits easy.
Wow.
So,
all right. I want to get your take real quickly on, we've got really, they're kind of like two mini world wars going on right now. Ukraine coming up on the 2-year anniversary. That's been the Eastern Front is like this rerun of World War One. It's not really been an aviation war, has it?
No. That's hopefully will change in the next 6 months or so. I think we've talked before on your show that, you know, the Ukrainians are going to get F-16s. And as a matter of fact, right here in the old Pueblo, they're training right now.
Ukrainian pilots
are here right now training. They're actually flying.
So
they're
done. F-16s?
Yes.
Wow.
So they're, from my understanding, they're done with the ground training portion and they're actually in the flying training.
So we could see them flying around Tucson or no?
Yeah, well, if you see an F-16 coming into the airport.
That could be.
It could be a very good chance.
Yeah. So these pilots will be going over to combat in the upcoming year, spring.
Yeah, I hope within the next 6 months they'll be operational. It's not just here in Tucson that they're training either. They're training in Europe as well.
Mm.
So there's several places that they're doing F-16 training right now. So when they're all done, hopefully they'll have actually a fairly big component. That and the munitions that we're going to be giving them, the air-to-surface munitions that we're going to be giving them, it'll end a trench warfare.
It will?
Yes. So, I don't know how many they have. There's other components that go into this kind of fight.
But they'll get action in the air from Russian counterparts.
Yes, possibly.
Possibly.
Now, we aren't, right now, they're, I just read this, last couple of days, they cleared, given the Ukrainians AIM-9s. So they'll be getting the AIM-9 Mike, which is a little bit older heat-seeking missile. There were some talks about AMRAAMs. AMRAAMs are something that the United States guards very closely. We have given some to our closest allies. At this point, I don't believe the Ukrainians are going to get AMRAAM, but it would change the air-to-air game.
That's a Raytheon product.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
It's the premier air-to-air missile out there right now. And put that on an F-16, the Russians would have no chance.
So the Israeli air action has been, wow. I mean, it's low-level bombing runs, right?
You know, I haven't been able to find out what they're using. I'm pretty sure they're using precision munitions, looking at the targets that they're going after. Obviously, they're mainly buildings.
So difficult in that urban environment.
Yeah, and with these tunnels, and it appears that Hamas, they're putting their command centers and their logistics centers under
In hospitals?
Yeah, under protected, you know, facilities by the by military, by mm-hmm. by treaty, yeah. we wouldn't be putting things under there. And because they're doing that, you can actually take, if it's against the Geneva Convention to bomb a hospital.
Yes.
Until your enemy uses that hospital for protection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on right now with the Israelis, since the Hamas is using the hospitals to essentially be a shield.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a hospital off the Geneva target list. So now they can be legitimate targets.
Let's go back to commercial aviation in this country. Southwest had all sorts of problems last Thanksgiving and Christmas. Really a meltdown. I'm hearing mixed things out of them. I'm hearing that they have a new computer system. They've got a new way of scheduling crews. What are you hearing?
I've been hearing the same thing. As a matter of fact,
but some say it's not enough. That's why I said mixed.
Yeah, I was just talking to a retired Southwest pilot right before I came over here, mm-hmm. and he was telling me that Southwest not only has updated a lot of their computer systems, as a matter of fact, Southwest took great pride in using their own software,
mm-hmm.
and they've been doing that for years and years and years, and I think it finally just pooped out on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know if they built their own or not, but it's looking like they're getting things on track. Mm-hmm. It looks like they're going to be able to handle this year much better than they did last year, not to mention they also have a pilot crunch going on, and they can't train enough pilots right now. They're buying more simulators to get their enough pilots through. So
that's another area we've talked about, Jeff, in the past, that the training now for pilots has changed. There's no two ways about it. The companies, the airline companies, need pilots, and some of the hour requirements have changed, haven't they?
Yeah. And there's legislation to change them even more. What we have to be careful about is knee-jerk reactions with this. There was a reason, you know, back prior to, and I can't remember when the accident was, but it was a turbine-powered or a turboprop-powered airplane flying into Buffalo that crashed. And that's where a lot of these hour requirements came from, because they felt like the crew didn't have enough hours.
As I recall, that was a regional jet, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, they iced up going into Buffalo.
And I've read the same thing, that was kind of a watershed moment for the whole training deal.
And that changed it, where you couldn't become an airline pilot until you had at least 1,500 hours total time. That is in flux right now. And there are exceptions to that rule. There always has been. But we can't just go back to the way it used to be, or you're going to see a lot more of these runway incursion problems.
And it used to be, if you were flying in the military, you didn't really have that difficulty reaching those hour requirements.
It depends. Fighters fly a lot less, but yeah, they are also given a certain component that they can multiply those hours, because the hours are more valuable, I guess.
Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You do a lot more in an hour flying a fighter than you do in an airliner.
Yeah.
But
the military isn't the pipeline it once was.
No, it's not.
For commercial aviation.
It's not anymore. And that's because the military's kind of getting out of the pilot world. You know, I don't want to say that exactly, but there's been a lot less need for pilots.
Do I hear you kind of an undercurrent of the drones? Or
there's a lot of drones out there.
I mean,
there's still a need for
the
them,
unmanned or unwoman pilot.
But when you start talking like F-22s and F-35s, you're talking about airplanes that can do a lot more per hour, mm-hmm. per se. So your requirement for more airplanes is less. Now, they did come back and said, okay, we don't have enough of these, and they ended up buying another 250 F-15s that they're building and buying right now. These are like super-duper, they're called F-15EXs, and they're going to be filling the stopgap between the two.
All right, Jeff Lattice, always a pleasure. Thank you very much, Jeff, and good luck with your future endeavors. Well,
thank you, Bill. I'm going to come back more often.
I hope so. I love having you here in studio with us. That's going to do it on behalf of Captain Lattice and John, engineering and producing our program on the other side of the glass. Jeff, by the way, we hope you and yours have a wonderful Thanksgiving, okay?
Well, thank you, Bill.
All right. Hope everybody has a great afternoon.